One, two, three, four.
Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. This is Noah Filipiak. I have two podcasts, and I struggle to say the right title whenever I start them. I'm here today with some very special guests. Sarah Arthur, you are a Behind the Curtain legend now because you're the first one ever to be on the podcast twice, and you were on the anniversary episode. Right. So welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Aaron is here with Aaron Wasinger, who they have co-written a book, The Year of Small Things, Radical Faith for the Rest of Us. Aaron says it's her debut book, and it is Sarah's 47th book.
That's right. That's so right. She's very prolific.
Sarah as well. We're glad to have a rookie author and such a prolific author as well. 47 books. That's a lot, Sarah. That is a lot of books. That's too many books.
It's more like 11 or 12.
Aaron
and I were trying to remember.
You see certain authors and they're like, here's all their previous books, and they list out like 100 books. You're like, I'm not going to read any of those. There's too many of them. You got to keep it, you know.
Yeah, palatable.
Palatable, that's right. So Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove did the foreword for The Year of Small Things. It just released on January 31st. You can look at the book online at yearofsmallthings.com, as well as lots of extras, including a podcast called The Small Things Podcast, which is at iTunes and Podbean. Podcasting tip, try to get the right title to your podcast when you you say it.
I struggle with that.
You can follow Sarah at saraharthur.com and Aaron at aaronwasinger.com. And I'm sure you're both all over social media as well.
Yes, we are. We literate.
Because you're authors.
We're authors. We're out there.
We authors have to own social media and get everyone to like us.
Aaron is at Some Wonderland.
And Sarah is at Holy Dreaming.
There you go. Because if you don't like an author on social media, we cry.
Please like us.
Yeah, please like us.
Noah has issues with platform, but he's going to be okay.
I will not be okay.
Don't read Michael Hyatt or you will cry all over again.
I already have. I try not to mention that name. Thank you for doing that for me.
Sorry.
Yes. Episode 29 of the Behind the Curtain podcast, just a few episodes ago, I interviewed Shane Claiborne. I encourage you to check that out. I know Shane's ministry has played a big role in the Year of Small Things coming about. As we start, just for those that are not familiar with the term New Monasticism, can either one of you just give a brief backdrop of what New Monasticism is and where the origins of this book came from?
Yeah. So the Year of Small Things is taking a look at some of the practices of communities that are known as New Monastic and trying to translate those practices into settings that are just kind of typical American suburban settings, because that's where my husband and I find ourselves. But New Monastic communities are forming all over the United States. They're made up of kind of youngish Christians of all backgrounds, evangelical, Catholic, kind of a hodgepodge of youngish Christians that are sensing a call to downward mobility in solidarity with those who struggle. So often in urban centers, they live communally. They practice hospitality to strangers. They practice simplicity. A lot of times they're involved in different versions of activism in their local context or in their state. And some of them, like Shane, were involved at the national level. He was arrested last week or 2 weeks ago for protesting the death penalty, which you had interviewed him about that book.
He invited me to come, and I said, well, I have to check with my wife if I'm allowed to get her, if I can come. And he said something like, I said, I don't know if she'll let me get arrested. And he's like, oh, it's no big deal. You'll just be in jail a couple of days.
So, right.
Needless to say, my wife did not let me go to get arrested.
Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, who's also close with Shane and their communities are similar. He was there but did not get arrested. And so there's a whole strategy around it. And he and I talked about that because he was here this past Sunday with us. To help us launch the Year of Small Things and talking about new monastic communities. And activism is not everyone's call. I thought it was interesting for him to talk about, you know, like some of you may be called to be the lawyers that help the people out that are getting arrested, and some of you may be called to be the people praying for the folks that are going there to get arrested. So, but just so you know, I've never been arrested for Jesus. That was not a requirement for living in the household that my husband and I lived in. But yeah, while we were students in seminary at Duke Divinity School, we lived in an intentional Christian household, very similar to the Simple Way in Philadelphia where Shane is, very similar to Rupa House where Jonathan is. We were not alone. There are households like this all over. But we lived in the inner city of Durham. We practiced hospitality to women and children that needed a place to stay. We often tell people that it's like if you from your small group from church decided that you were all going to go live in the local homeless shelter. And the difference being you're staying while everybody else is coming right. and going. So that's what it was like. And so then the Year of Small Things is our attempt to, you know, once our bishop appointed us as United Methodists to a suburban congregation in Michigan after graduate school, you know, we still felt that the call of Jesus is with the poor. That's where we find him. That's where we find God at work even now in our nation and in our world. And so what does it mean to translate some of those communal practices we're involved in into a context that's not very radical?
Erin, have you ever been arrested for activism?
I have never been arrested for Jesus. It's a squad goal of mine.
It kind of makes you less of a Christian, I think.
I think it really does. Yeah. It does.
We're gonna talk about that. Erin, how did you get wrapped into all of this?
Sarah is very persuasive. No, my husband Dave and I, we are the rest of us. So we have never lived in an intentional community. We were editors at a newspaper in Wisconsin, and we moved to Lansing. And that's when I started reading Shane Claiborne and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. But we also had three young children, and so it started to feel like an impossibility. Like maybe new monasticism was just for the cool single Christians.
Right.
And at the same time, we had met Tom and Sarah, and we decided to get together and start reading some books together and having discussions. It ended up being a weekly dinner where we would talk about those questions. And that's really how the project was born. Yeah.
So in your intro, this will hit on a joke I was sort of making there. You write, Sarah, I think you wrote this, occasional superior asides. In parentheses, oh, we I think you're talking about when you were moving in parentheses, oh, we won't be using the dishwasher because insert self-righteous moralizing about our former life in a quote radical household combined with barely informed commentary about the global water crisis and probably something else about sustainability here, unquote. I laughed at that, and I was glad you put it in the intro, because when I look at new monasticism, even as I read, you know, Irresistible Revolution, which I love, and it was so helpful to me, I think there's two sides of a conversation that needs to happen. On one side, I think there's a defensiveness that comes from, you know, established Christians, sort of the rest of us, that will say things like, well, I would say they dismiss this idea of new monasticism, or if you don't want to use that word, they dismiss this idea of a more radical faith, even an idea of living below our means, because it feels like you're telling me, well, I have air conditioning, so I'm not a real Christian.
Sure.
I reject that. You know, it's about the gospel. I'm saved by grace. And what you're doing is you're adding a bunch of rules to it, and it can be dismissed. On the other side, I think there is some legitimate judgmentalism that comes in. I don't get that sense from the main leaders of the movement, which I think really is a beautiful thing. Though leaders like Shane are very direct. They're very direct about mm-hmm. things still. There's a mm-hmm. section in Irresistible Revolution that he titles The Search for a Real Christian. And I believe it ends with his story with him spending time with Mother Teresa. And he uses some of those titles for a little shock value, a little clickbait, and then you get to read them. But how do you transcend those two things? Because I think it alienates people from the conversation where those doing it, whether they mean to or not, it can feel a little bit standoffish. And then those not doing it, I think sometimes feel like, well, that's not for me. I'm just going to live the American dream and I'll be saved and go to heaven. How do we get above that to actually start practicing some of these practices?
Erin just handed the mic to me.
Well, we were supposed to have three mics, but we won't go there.
Yeah, I mean, for starters, I think it's important to note that you know, my engagement in this has been nothing if not an adventure in grace. because I just have experienced God's presence and graciousness all through this. And it was heartening. Tom and I had to go back to North Carolina, sadly, for a funeral at the beginning of January. And we went and stayed with David and Rebecca, our former housemates, at the Isaiah House, and they're still practicing hospitality. They're now raising two boys there. I mean, they had babies when we were there, but now their kids are elementary age. And David had like remodeled the whole house. This is what he does, and he's a craftsman. And for the first time, we got to see like his love of beauty. Because when we lived there, there were 12 of us, lots of kids, and it was just a disaster all the time. I mean, like just mopping the kitchen floor was a hardship, and they did not use their dishwasher. And I remember walking into his kitchen over Christmas break this year and be like, "You guys have a dishwasher?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he kind of goes out. And Tom says to him, "Wow, we knew you guys when you were poor."
Oh, nice.
And the look on David's face was awesome. It was like conflicted, like, well, but. But they're here. They're still in the inner city. They're still practicing hospitality. But they had a little chance to breathe for a while and regroup and recognize that having a beautiful home welcomes the homeless too into a space that's warm and inviting and useful, right? You can wash your dishes in the dishwasher, right, which is actually a health issue. There's lots of reasons. But there was grace there, and it was important for us to see the ways that our housemates are, discerning what God's call is on their life. And that discernment looks different from year to year, from day to day, from week to week, and from family to family. And so our biggest challenge, I think, and you're really good at explaining this too, is how do you practice discernment together about what God is calling you in particular to do?
Right. So we determined too, like, as I mentioned, we are not total radicals over here in the Wassinger camp. But through practicing discernment with Tom and Sarah and having someone there as a covenantal friend who will push you a little bit in some of your questions, and question like, oh, really, is that the American dream or is that what God is calling you to do?
Are you just being a scared white woman?
Are you being a scared white woman? That's Tom's favorite question, by the way. That's a white woman question.
In the book a few times.
But it rings in my head every day. No, it's just you mentioned that, you're creating a whole bunch of new rules. We don't need to follow this. I'm saved by grace and, absolutely. But taking small steps towards living into a life that's more radical is all we're asking. You don't have to jump in on behalf of Jesus. Right.
Right.
Because this is where we see Jesus. Our church right now is studying Hebrews 13, the last chapter of that letter. And it's all just straight up practical, like keep on inviting strangers because, some of us have welcomed angels.
Yeah.
Keep on, don't give in to having a love of money. Be content with what you have. I mean, it's a pep talk in all of the areas that we're talking about. And if the early church assumed that Christians were to be doing these things, then I think it's important for us to take that seriously. So.
You guys have mentioned radical hospitality a few times already in the interview. What are some ways that you can, or how do you show radical hospitality without being taken advantage of or abused?
Aaron's family and our family practice hospitality in different ways. Tom and I, for years, have welcomed the homeless to live with us. And because my husband is super intentional, as soon as somebody comes to stay with us, whether it's short term or long term, we sit down with a covenant with them. And it's a covenant we create together. We have a kind of basic structure that we put in there. And then we invite them to be like, well, what else, needs to be in here? What creates a safe space or a healthy space for you?
Yeah.
As simple as like, please knock before you come down my hallway or whatever it is, like, hey, man on the floor or whatever.
Right.
So that's one of the ways that we do that. And we pull that covenant out when there are questions come up about how the relationship is going. And that's pretty much the number one practice that we do when it comes to welcoming people in our home. But also, we're not an emergency shelter, for somebody in extreme circumstances. Mm-hmm. We're usually, somebody's been in a shelter and they are ready for the next step, but they don't have quite enough money for a down payment or for their first month's rent or whatever it is that they need. So that's we're not social workers. We're not trying to fix anyone. But we do prayerfully discern if this person is a good fit, and we sense that they have some of the tools that they need to create stability with us. But right now, I mean, we have a housemate that's been with us for 5 years, mm-hmm. and she's saving up to be able to buy a home. Like, yeah. This is significant.
Dave and I practice hospitality outside our home, so I don't feel that there's quite as many issues that come up personally for us. Mm-hmm. We offer, we're mentors for refugees recently arrived in the United States, and our goal is to help them be independent. And there are some issues where it is really hard to say, you know, all they need is a car seat. Like, we have the money to buy them a car seat. But it's not our goal to become a charity.
Walmart.
It's not our, right. It's not our goal to rob them of a chance to figure this out on their own. Like, we can guide them. I can say, well, the safety council offers car seats. Let's get you connected. It's our job to continue to push them toward independence, not necessarily because it's the American dream, although they have it, they want it. It's more because it's empowering to them, and that's feels like hospitality to us.
We've mentioned the American dream a couple times in your covenantal friendship chapter. Sarah, you said, rather than being the last to abandon the false promises of the American dream, we as Christ followers need to be at the front edge of something different. When I think of the American dream, I sort of think of my upbringing, white suburbia, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, where you currently live. And Aaron, you guys live in a rural area, correct?
Not anymore.
Not
we
anymore.
Live in Lansing.
In Lansing now. Okay, gotcha.
That was all part of this journey.
Okay, wonderful. You can tell me more about that. But I'm wondering, how do you tell people that line without telling them to abandon the suburbs or to abandon, you know, living in the country? And I ask that for my own helping me with it. So I'm pretty passionate about these things. I asked Shane the same question, you know. He's obviously passionate about these things, much more of an extreme even than I am. But we live in an inner city neighborhood. I'm very involved in Christian Community Development Association. One of their core tenets is relocation. And I always have that tension myself as a pastor and teacher of, I want people to do this. I want people to take up relocation. I want them to do it with me. But at the same time, fully knowing, as we already talked about, we're not saved by that. We're saved by Jesus. We don't have to add anything to that. And so, I mean, I like that line in there. It felt not strong in a bad way, but it felt strong. Rather than being the last to abandon the false promises of the American dream, we as Christ followers need to be at the front edge of something different. Yet in your book, you're not telling people you need to move out of the suburbs. So how do those two things go together?
Right. Whatever Shane Claiborne said is our answer. That sounds good, right? Right. We trust him. No. In the year of small things, we're not speaking to the crowd. We're speaking to the individual. And we're talking about discernment. And we're talking about discernment in these covenantal friendships. So this is not us saying everyone needs to move into the city, abandon the suburbs. This is us saying, if you live in the suburbs, talk about with your covenantal friendship how you're connecting to the city. If you're living in a rural space, chances are you don't have a heart for moving into the city. But how are ways that what you do out there in rural America can support the city? So, for instance, are you growing things that you can contribute to a food bank? If you're living in the suburbs, do you have a garden of your own? Could you volunteer in schools in the inner city? I mean, these are questions that you ask each other. We can't tell you exactly what that's going to look like, though.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth mentioning, too, that there is plenty of poverty in rural areas. There's plenty of poverty, surprisingly enough, in suburbia. So when we first moved here, this was very eye-opening for me because Holt is actually a suburb of Lansing, but it has one of the lowest the cost of housing here is one of the lowest in the region. And so it attracts people who are struggling financially because they don't want to live in the city either. And so they come to a suburb and all the ways that they're struggling come with them. And so, you know, we had one car when we first moved here and I rode the bus all the time. Well, I was the only white suburban mom on that bus. Everyone else was, you know, or of a particular demographic, I should say, socioeconomically. Like, everyone else was on the bus because they had to be on the bus to get to work, to whatever. And I was on the bus because I lost the argument with Tom over who got the car. No, it was understood. I mean, he was the one with the job that took him out of the home. So obviously he would take the car. But it taught me something about the suburban poor as well. So while New Monasticism has an emphasis on relocating to abandoned places of empire and urban centers being at the heart of that, that's not necessarily the only emphasis that God puts on the heart of a Christian. The difference is, are you living here because you want to keep on that track of the American dream? Or are you living here recognizing all of its false promises and with an eye toward how you can still, you know, be alongside those who struggle? So literally, like, across McHugh over here is a trailer park. And across Eifer on the other side is a trailer park. That's why the buses come this far south. Otherwise, they wouldn't even be here. And we've gotten to know some folks in the Windmill Trailer Park because they go to our church and they're like family. They were here Christmas morning with us, Paul and Marion, who are in the book. And so this is that's a long answer to your really good question.
That's helpful.
But Aaron and Dave's story is fascinating. I think you need to ask them about that.
So you
actually
guys moved into the city as a result of this journey?
Yeah, we did. But first, Sycamore Creek Church bought a building. So before, we had been renting a space in Lansing Christian School, kind of out in this industrial parkish area.
South Lansing.
Sort of at the corner of Holt and Mason and East Lansing and Lansing. And now they moved into a Lansing neighborhood. And for us, we were looking to be planted somewhere too. And this is at the point where Dave and I were saying, my husband was saying, well, do we stay in this job, or, you know, do I want to get the bigger job? We could move to Cincinnati or somewhere on the East Coast. And that has always been his dream, is, you know, that's the American dream. You get a better job and you move to follow it. And we decided, no, we're going to stay. And because our church bought a house in a neighborhood, we started looking for homes in that area so we could be living in the same neighborhoods where our church was, being with the same people, sharing life, not just on Sunday, but every day of the week in that neighborhood. And we ended up finding one. It's about several blocks away.
Yeah,
whenever I have to go into church to work, I can run there and then run back, physically run on my feet.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It feels like my life is very centered on Lansing. That's my home now.
That's awesome. And I love how you phrase it, where it invites people to take those steps. But if God has them in a spot, God works on all of us differently. And we're all different places in life. And wherever you are, you can start practicing these sort of things. I think it's what makes your book so accessible. As I read it, one thing that I liked so much is how honest you are, and you use it with humor a lot of times about the challenges you faced in doing these things. I'm wondering if you can talk briefly about just some of the main challenges you each faced in trying to implement. So you took one practice a month was the concept of the book. These, as you try to implement these practices, what were some of the main challenges that got in the way? It sort of reminded me of, I forget the exact phrase, but on Pinterest they have all those recipes. Have you seen those? And they look really
Pinterest fails.
You know, like, and then they show the photo of like what it looked like on Pinterest, like the Cookie Monster faced cupcakes, and then here's the ones I made, and it looks like a 2-year-old just like smashed everything with their. That's kind of what I liked about your book. It was like just so honest. Like, here, we made the cupcakes.
Here's what they look
it's
like.
Kind of a Pinterest fail. But the Lord is gracious.
The Lord is gracious.
So tell me about some of those challenges.
Challenges is children.
Absolutely.
Children and their health. That's
Amen
a huge
that.
Challenge. We said we were going to meet weekly and constantly. Our schedules became a challenge right away. We were always moving it, moving times. Even now, like, well, can we meet over here? Because Tom has a meeting in Potterville.
If you brought contagion to this house, Noah, we blame you utterly if we're not going to get to meet again for 3 weeks.
Right.
Just for everyone knows the history. We were supposed to record this a week ago. My kids were puking for the 4 days. They got better. And now yesterday they got sick again. Not puking, but if Sarah and Aaron get sick.
But you're going to save the world, Noah.
It's my fault.
You're going to save the world.
It's my fault.
That's right.
With this interview.
With this interview.
This interview.
This is it.
Will save the world.
Absolutely.
I can retire after this.
No, the other thing was is that at the beginning of the month, we would have a theme, and we would say, well, this month's theme is church. We'll be planted in the church. That's when Dave and I started to dream about buying a house. But if you've ever bought a house, you know it doesn't happen like on anyone's time frame but the banks and, you know, the city. We got a grant to live there from the city. And all those things take so much time, and it felt like we were stalling out a lot. The conversation we have in the next chapter about schools is another one that, like, we that's a Pinterest fail for my life still. Like, it continues to go on and on. So for us, like, God doesn't work on a month-by-month basis. Mm-hmm. He plants the seed, but he doesn't always plant it in the month where you think you're going to be talking about church or school.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me, too, like, probably what has felt like the biggest fail for Tom and I is just we can't move. Like, we're in the suburbs, mm-hmm. and our heart has been in the city. We lived in the city.
And you live in the parsonage.
And we live in a parsonage,
yeah.
Right.
So the church owns this house.
Yeah, and it's a phenomenal house. I was in parsonages as a kid, and none of them were ever this nice. It's a wonderful house. And actually, it does allow us, it has tons of room, so we can practice hospitality in ways that we probably couldn't afford to otherwise, as far as our own space. And the church has been a big part of that, remodeling the downstairs so we could have extra guest rooms and things. But the biggest fail always feels like, you know, we're driving 20 minutes, half an hour into church, right? Mm-hmm. But this is all God's amazing graciousness. We have just partnered with another church in Potterville, which is a more rural congregation outside of Lansing, which is 20 minutes in the other direction. So literally, if we lived in the city, my husband, who's now a senior pastor with these various congregations, would have a much longer drive to get to our rural church that is jumping on board with the mission and vision of reaching people for Jesus. They have a bread drop. They're reaching the poor in their neighborhood, too. So God knew, even if I was grumpy, he was like, just hold on. You know, come on now. Just hold on. And there's so many ways that living here, while it feels like a huge challenge, and it is, because it's easy to just kind of get complacent because it is the American dream. It has also been a tremendous gift. So, yeah. And I thank God for that.
That's awesome. You mentioned kids, and I am with you on that. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. My wife's pregnant with our third.
Congratulations! Yeah. So, congratulations.
Thank you. Going back into baby world. My life felt normal for like a week. And it was like, oh.
Say goodbye.
Say goodbye. Yeah. Was funny because the kid picture reminded me of, Aaron, it was one of the parts you wrote about Christmas and about Christmas morning. And this was, I think, in the section you guys were talking about budgeting, and you talked a lot about budgeting and how it relates to materialism and these sorts of things. So,
right.
So you told the story where you had this very small budget for your kids' presents, and like one of your they opened them, and when your kids like was kind of crying, and then the sibling said, "Don't worry, tomorrow we'll go to grandma and grandpa's house. And you have the quote from your parents or your in-laws, I don't remember, but they're like, "We don't do simplicity, right?"
Right.
And
right.
You can put that in your book.
Yeah.
So I laughed so hard because for my kids who are 5 and 3, they totally know now what's going on at Christmas, especially my 5-year-old. And I feel so torn because Christmas presents are like a drug. They are a drug.
Yes, it's insatiable.
It is insatiable. They get high on these things. They open them up. They don't even. They get euphoric. Then they throw it off to the side. They could care less about it. They'll probably never play with it again. And
right.
Then you say, "Where's the next one?" And they have a pile of presents. And then the next day, all they want to do is watch the iPad.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And then you look at American culture and adults and all the debt people are in, and the addictions, right? The addictions that we have, and how we live above our means, and how really even when it comes to talking to the church or not the church about orienting our life around the poor and around those in need, it's like we're not hardwired for that
because
mm-hmm. we've been hardwired by like Christmases,
right?
And birthdays with our kids, where we get entitled, we think we're royalty. Yet if my kid doesn't get these presents, they're going to weep. And even if I don't buy them presents, guess what? My parents are going to, and my wife's
right.
parents are going to. what the heck are we supposed to do?
Right.
What do we do about this?
Well, I think in part, like grandparents, aunts, and uncles who are going to spoil your children, you can talk to them beforehand, but they're probably still going to do it. And that's a place where you can say thank you. Like you can learn just to be mm-hmm. grateful for that. A lot of times we'll ask for very practical things from our grandparents at Christmas. So, you know, we need snow boots. Can you get them some snow boots? Our kids don't like that particularly well. They do notice, like, their cousin one Christmas got a golf cart. Like, how do you compete with a golf cart? Are you kidding? That was actually the Christmas that, like, we made marshmallow shooters for them, and they didn't even know what to do with them. I'm like, marshmallow shooters are the best gift ever. Are you kidding me? So there is a cultural divide there between us and our extended family. This year, Christmas was really cool, though, because Christmas Eve, we went to worship at Sycamore Creek. And then afterward, we went over to our friends who are from Africa, and they're Muslim. And they knew it was Christmas Eve, so they brought out a whole bunch of candy, and she made this, like, it's sort of like a pancake. It's delicious. And she kept saying, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. And we went home, and we didn't open a single gift, and that felt really good. And the kids had fun playing with their kids. We went to Grandma and Grandpa's house the week before Christmas. So by the time we got to Christmas morning, when I gave them Dave and I gave them their two or three little gifts, like I think Alice got Pokemon cards and a pair of jeans, because that's what she didn't need the Pokemon cards, but that was, you know, that was sort of like placating her.
Right,
like,
right.
Here's this.
Don't cry when you open your jeans.
Right. Really, you need them. So it felt like we had put enough distance between it, and now my kids are old enough that we can talk about why we're doing this.
Yeah.
Well, and in the book we talk about how Aaron set a crazy low budget of like $25.
Yeah.
And how in trying it was pretty legalistic. She admits later, and that also had no joy in it. So
I remember that.
Where's the balance?
Really,
you know,
it was like you said,
where's the balance?
Like we lost Jesus.
It was still focused on stuff instead of being focused on Jesus.
Yeah.
It was still focused on stuff instead of Jesus, but materialism in the opposite direction. So how do you like anti-materialism instead of just for Jesus? Like because it's his birthday, we are, you know.
Yeah.
But birthdays in themselves are kind of a mess. And we actually, our very first episode of the Small Things podcast, we talk about that because Micah's birthday was, we were really challenged. He turned six. And you do want to kill the fatted calf sometimes to celebrate this life that's in the world. But we're not going to throw like the birthday party he went to, you know, with like a pony and a circus and like, you know, actual like little kid ATVs and like there were lots of fails.
It feels like fails, but I think our kids will appreciate it someday.
Yeah,
that's
but
right.
in the appendix of our book, we have the letter that we wrote to our family, mm-hmm. our extended families for Christmas, and the invitation is this: we it's not our kid's birthday, it's not our birthday. We invite you to give them each one gift, because if you all give them one gift, they're still getting dozens of gifts. Don't give Tom and I anything though. Please just write a check to our Christmas Eve offering, which goes to missions,
mm-hmm.
and you're welcome to give on top of that too, more than what you would normally give to us, and. Pretty much our whole family like respected that, and it was really
nice,
it was really beautiful. Aaron also has a nice family in different ways.
They're lovely people,
right.
But they said no, thank you, friend.
Yeah, but I think what you bring up is a great point, because you tried these different things. Some worked well, some didn't, but you learned from them, and you never would have learned these things had you not tried.
Exactly.
What does it hurt to try?
Right.
And so then you can do it again. With it, it's not like we have to get it perfectly, you know, we're never going to get it perfectly. I think that's the whole point,
right?
In conclusion, I always like, so the name of this podcast is Behind the Curtain, and I ask that to different ministry leaders. I consider any author a ministry leader, especially in something Sarah, you and I talked about this a lot on our last interview, is about the, you know, the insecurity that goes into going to get published, and then there's all, you have to get people to like you, and you know, we joke about it, but it's a serious thing the way the industry is set up right now. What I found for me when I started my church, which now was about 11 years ago when I started it, we launched it 10 years ago, about a year in, I started really suffering from depression symptoms. And so, Aaron, I really appreciated in the book how you were very open about that. You talked about depression and a struggle that you've had with depression, and how that interwove And 10 years later, I still take depression medicine. I'm still struggling with depression. Now, I praise God. I've had some great, it's been a great fuel for me, mm-hmm. That I've learned from. And one more, we didn't get a chance to talk about spiritual practices, but I'll give a quick plug for that. You guys talk a lot about spiritual practices, and I've just discovered spiritual practices in the last 2 years. I go to some retreats led by Ruth Haley Barton, who I interviewed in episode 12. And I've learned spiritual practices that have helped me with my depression, mm-hmm. in major ways. But I think a lot of ministry leaders struggle with depression in different ways. Not everybody does, but anxiety, depression. Aaron, can you share, first of all, thank you for just naming it and saying the word.
Yeah.
Because there's many people that I found that simply say, I've never heard anyone in the church talk about that. Thank you. And they always feel like they're this major sinner, or they feel right. All this shame because of depression. How is depression and the year of small things related to each other for you through the writing of this book?
Depression is part of my DNA. Mm-hmm. I've been on antidepressants now since college, which has been mathematically a long time ago. And for me, I can't separate depression from the rest of it, because that's part of the lens through which I view everything.
Yeah.
At the same time, a year of small things broke things down into so little pieces that it felt doable. So at those moments where you feel like you cannot give one more thing, like I cannot add one more thing or I will break, small things says, okay, then stop. Like, yeah. What are you doing this for? We're doing this, you know, for Jesus. There should be joy in this. Just take a break. You are not Jesus, which was a hard thing to hear. But
the job of Savior has already been taken.
Right. Right. The world doesn't need me. So that was helpful. It was also helpful. We talk about it toward the end of the book. I had built trust with our covenantal friends over the course of a year. It wasn't something that I necessarily would have stood up in church and admitted to in the beginning. And it felt really safe in that space. And now I've become more empowered to talk about it, because other people have said, I've struggled with that for years. I always thought it was kind of like this secular problem that people have, right. And there was something wrong with me. There was some book someone referred me to. It's a Christian author, and he says that depression is unconfessed sin, and that veers way away from where I'm experienced depression. It's a chemical imbalance in my brain.
Yeah.
So having this new safe space where we can talk about this, it's empowering for people.
Yeah, just being on this journey with Erin and her family was a beautiful thing, because it was a good reminder that we're not doing this because out of some deep well of our own emotional resources.
Yeah.
It's all God's love and grace working through us. And there are going to be days when you wake up and you know, you have to say out loud, I am not the hero of this story.
So last night, we usually have dinner now on Wednesdays at the Arthurs. And Sarah asked me on Monday, hey, what are we thinking about Wednesday for dinner? I'm at the grocery store. Text me some ideas. And I wrote back and I said, well, I was looking at my calendar and I don't have a day of rest. Wednesday needs to be that day this week, mm-hmm. because that's just how it's working out. It's my daughter's birthday. You can't move a birthday. Like, unfortunately, she's old enough now. She knows the date.
Right.
And her allowing me just to say, can we skip this week, felt really good. I mean, that was soul care right there.
Yeah, I didn't angry text you like, what? You committed to this. Come on. I recognize, you know, it's February, mm-hmm. and we're all busy, but Aaron needs to breathe.
Yeah. One, two, three, four.
Well, if you want to hear more from Sarah and Aaron, you can do so with the Small Things podcast. Check that out on iTunes and at Podbean, and you can go to yearofsmallthings.com. I will also have links at my blog at acrossroads.net to their podcasts, to their social media links, as well as their own websites, saraharthur.com and aaronwassinger.com. Also, the interview I did with Sarah was episode 19, the famous now 1 year anniversary of the podcast episode. You can check that out. And actually, in that, Sarah and I talked a lot about what you've mentioned briefly here, that we are not Jesus, and that's a hard lesson to learn. And I love that you guys talk about that in the Year of Small Things book. So thank you for sharing your hearts here on the podcast and in your book. And I'm excited for your book because I think it does serve a missing, it's a bridge. It's a bridge between what really is an exciting movement of the faith and a large community of believers that are wondering, how in the world am I able to connect with this movement of the faith? And your book fits that so well. So thank you both for what you're doing for the kingdom and for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Noah. It was great. Thank you.